Welcome to the MUFG Global Markets Podcast. I'm John Cook, and I'm joined by Haley Orr in MUFG's Capital Markets Strategy Group, as well as Toby Petroselli, the Head of Environmental and Sustainability Management at MUFG. It's Monday, November 15th, 2021. Welcome to the podcast, Haley and Toby.
Great to be here, John.
Thank you.
And great to have you both back on the podcast. And Toby, why don't we start with you? We've heard a lot about COP26 all year long. For a bit of context, how should our listeners think about the importance of COP relative to the 2015 meeting in Paris that yielded the Paris Climate Accords?
Sure, absolutely. Definitely want to give a little background here. Thank you again for having me. I'd like to start off with what is COP26? What does that stand for, right? So it's the 26th meeting of the Conference of Parties, which is hosted by the United Nations and brings together around 200 countries to try to agree on what the international community should do about addressing climate change. So what is really the international plan to effectually address the existential threat of climate change we're all facing? This 26th meeting, you know, is really to discuss this activity writ large. And now most of you have heard of what we've seen in the past, which was the Paris Climate Agreement. That was the 21st meeting that happened in Paris back in 2015. And the reason that gets so much attention is that that was the first agreement where everyone agreed to the same goal as it relates to what we've been trying to achieve, you know, in this last 2 weeks here in Glasgow. So that is to keep global warming temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, ideally below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which was dubbed a tagline throughout the conference, keep 1.5 degrees alive. Now, that's a huge deal because it gets everyone on the same page about what we're trying to achieve here. So the issue with Paris and what happened is it did not stipulate in the agreement how we're going to achieve this. No set plan, no accountability, no true structure that would actually keep us within that goal. So in fact, the Paris Agreement, as it stands today, is only one country of the 196 that ratified it actually is on track to stay within the 1.5 degrees, and that's Gambia. So Glasgow was meant to really reconvene on what is necessary to stay on track, what structures, accountability mechanisms, even defined spending amounts are needed to ensure we stay within that goal. So simply stated, to give you a round, is we need to do less of the bad, such as coal mining, more of the good, such as renewable energy, and we need to invest in the innovation that's going to get us there. So COP has thematically approached each of these areas over the course of 12 days. Firstly, they really focused on the reliance on fossil fuels. How do we phase out our reliance on fossil fuels? And we know that burning such fuels accelerate climate change. And so this makes the problem worse. How do we divest and drive away from that? How do we shutter the coal-fired power generation plants around the globe that we know are really exacerbating our problems here? So how do we stop no new ones from opening? This was really a core component to the conference. Another aspect that COP really dove deep into were ways in which we are doing more of the good. How to mobilize capital to more clean infrastructure, things like renewable energy projects, solar, wind, geothermal, hydro, and really ensuring an increasing amount of our energy production comes from those renewable energy sources that will, again, not accelerate climate change as it is. So investing in infrastructure that will permanently change societal behaviors is critical. Things like electric vehicle charging stations, for instance, that will make it easier to actually drive a car that is not based on combustion engines. We need this infrastructure and these mechanisms to be put in place, this capital to drive that innovation. Another scope that was covered in detail throughout the conference also was how to invest in the new. What are the advances that need capital to propel the transformation of our energy systems? This includes research and development that will ensure that we have the most innovative and exciting technologies that will help us transition to a clean energy economy and really decarbonize the grid, shall we? You know, going back to this really decarbonizing the economy, making sure that we can actually pull carbon out of the air by ways of capture and sequestration. All this in mind, the countries that have convened are all trying to keep to the 1.5 degree goal and keep that going. So this will require more stipulations. It's going to require real teeth in these agreements. It's going to require spending to be agreed upon, specifically in the developed countries like the US, that have created, quite frankly, a lot of the problem, and really set aside assistance to those in the developing countries that will bear the burden and the real brunt of climate change. So at the root of the summit, all in all, the idea of protecting future generations is really the core for our children, our grandchildren, and those who suffer most from inaction. So to encapsulate, you know, some of the key themes and pledges, I'd like to review them further, but I must also interject there have been criticisms of COP26 for its lack of inclusivity, key nations missing from certain announcements, even potential PR posturing with little past evidence to back up some credibility there. So it is true, there were some criticisms. There are some highlighted areas along this. And I personally, though, see a lot of hope from what was being announced and what hasn't been announced and committed to thus far. The U.S. is front and center in a lot of the new pledges and in the text that was finalized. So this is really a big departure from where we were 12 months ago. And then lastly, MUFG and where we stand, even from the finance perspective, where we sit, both public and private, really have been identified as a key lever to drive the required action. And this past summit has seen several key announcements that indicate it will be there to fund the clean energy transition.
Wow, I mean, that's a huge task. Sounds like good news is it sounds like there's a lot of progress, albeit, you know, maybe not as much as you'd like ideally. But let's talk specifically about the key outcomes of COP26. What is the importance of the Glasgow Climate Pact as example?
Right. So you know, just despite the fact that the conference lasted, it was supposed to last over 12 days, supposed to finish on Friday. Talks went into late Saturday evening. And the official agreement, the Glasgow Climate Pact, was completed. No question history was made in that and included several key themes that have never been written before. I'd say probably one of the biggest breakthroughs was that there was a line agreed that countries would end the use of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. Again, this was the first time fossil fuels were ever mentioned in a climate deal. They would also agree to seek a phasing down of unabated coal. So, you know, just to give you an idea, even us here at MUFG, we have a policy, direct policy relating to coal. We have agreed not to provide financing to new coal-fired power generation plants. And we've already begun reducing our exposure in that front. But when you're sitting in Glasgow and you're on the floor of the plenary on a Saturday night, there were last-minute fights where India and China, you know, the first and third largest emitters, managed to have the language watered down slightly from phasing out to phasing down coal. But nonetheless, coal will decrease, and we feel positive about that to some extent. But certain countries and their delegates voiced sincere disappointment and profound objection to some of the last minute tweaks that went into the agreement. Even COP26 president, Alex Sharma, had actually apologized for the way the progress and, you know, the process had unfolded in those last hours. He even said, you know, he felt that we can credibly say we've kept 1.5 degrees alive, which was the slogan mentioned throughout the Glasgow conference, but its pulse is weak. So if that gives you any indication of some sort of disappointment that, you know, resonated throughout the blue zone on Saturday into the weekend. You know, the core of the agreement, of course, says that countries need to halve their emissions by 2030. They agreed they would come back next year. Next year's conference will be in Egypt and try to revitalize their climate pledges and carbon emissions a little bit more, maybe even a lot more during the course of the 2020s in order to really reach that goal. Because the bad news is technically the world is still on track for about 2.4 degrees Celsius, which is for our American audience here, approximately 4.3 degrees Fahrenheit of global warming compared to, you know, the pre-industrial levels. Some other breakthroughs. One was an agreement on creating a global regulated carbon market. This is something that countries have been trying to agree on for the last 6 years. They reached a deadlock in this conversation in Madrid in 2019. That was the last convening before the pandemic. They finally managed to get an agreement over the finish line on Saturday. And even though some activists believe the language is weak and could lead to more emissions and greenwashing effectually, there are still a lot of questions on how that will be implemented So that still remains, but at least there's a carbon market in there. And that is a hot topic around, stabilizing markets in this regard. Some of the most vulnerable countries to climate change, however, like low-lying islands and African countries, did not obtain the money they needed from developed nations in order to tackle the inevitable changes of climate and the shift to green energy resources. This was more or less a liability fund, a sort of loss fund, where we were looking to really establish capital from developed nations to the emerging markets to obtain what they need in order to shift. The text, this is a true story, the text was originally inserted to address this. 138 countries signed onto that text Thursday, and then it was removed overnight, stating that they will simply have a dialogue that will continue on this topic to really fund the poorest nation suffering most from the effects of climate change. So this led to, again, another profound disappointment across the delegates on the floor. From our perspective as a bank, you know, this could be an opportunity to advance financing options and really support further green lending to these emerging economies. Speaking of banks, Bank of England, Mark Carney, set the bar. He drove to get finance industry elites to cut portfolio emissions to zero by mid-century. This was one of the biggest announcements at COP26 that came early in the first week, dubbed the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, GFANZ, that saw signatories overseeing about $130 trillion, aiming to set clear targets and timelines for greening their investments. Just to give you a little sidebar on MUFG, we've declared not only carbon neutrality for our internal operations by 2030, we've also declared carbon neutrality for our financed emissions, which is our clients' portfolios, by 2050. And we set a target to spend $330 billion in sustainable finance over the next 10 years as well. So as crucial to this conversation, the private market is in the largest shift in reallocation of capital we will ever see. The largest banks in the world, though, it's the kicker, including three from China, who finance most of the coal power in the world, did not sign the agreement. So quite frankly, as ambitious that pledge was, even something as simple as a fixed definition of what net zero is and how much money will actually be shifted into green activities was not agreed upon. So the reality is, you know, businesses have advanced far quicker than governments in this respect on the climate agenda, but companies understand that their future is tied to really having a stable market. And just lastly, a couple of aspects here. Oil giants were present. Major companies were there. BP, Royal Dutch Shell. We had corporate elites like Bill Gates of Microsoft, BlackRock's Larry Fink, all making headlines to cut emissions, really preparing for a greener world. But the challenge, however, is how governments and activists, I mean, we saw them, they were there protesting in the streets, including the likes of Greta Thunberg, and, you know, protesting for more change and action toward climate measures. You know, their whole protest really was, how do we keep these businesses accountable? The Science-Based Targets Initiative is there, kind of a parallel effort to governments to boost scrutiny and avoid greenwashing altogether. So this is really critical. They were really trying to set new rules around that. And the last two items that I thought were good to note are also the pledge here. 110 countries agreed to slash methane, which is another first in any climate pact. And another 100 or so of world leaders promised to end and reverse deforestation. This includes Brazil and Indonesia, to name a few. So those are some new mentions that were included in the pact. But we're ultimately, I think it was promising and definitely a step forward for the globe. John.
Thanks, Toby. That was extremely comprehensive. So Haley, I guess what would be helpful for me would be a bit of perspective. I'm curious how the agreement and negotiations stack up against expectations going into the conference.
Sure. Happy to do so, John. And look, I think Toby gave, as you said, an extremely comprehensive look at what we got in the Glasgow Climate Pact. And absolutely, I would agree that there was some very strong progress and some truly groundbreaking components to this agreement. The first time mentions around methane and several other of those areas. But if we take a step back and look at what the demands were and what the biggest expectations were going into the conference, and where we stacked up against them. It's really a mixed scorecard. So just going sort of one by one, first off, this idea of combating global temperature increases, it's really sort of the crux of this entire climate agreement. And Toby mentioned the mantra, keeping 1.5 degrees alive. And at the end of the day, Toby mentioned this, that the new commitments that have been made by countries, so the national targets, will keep us on track for 2.7 degrees, so far outside of the 1.5 degree hope and expectation out of the Paris conference. Now, a bit of a silver lining here, though, if you factor in other commitments that are not necessarily a part of the official targets, these are targets coming from the private sector. These are announcements around net zero that have not necessarily been codified into actual policy commitments. Then you get somewhere in the range of a 1.8 to 2.4 degree increase over pre-industrial levels. So certainly keeping 1.5 more in the crosshairs, as it were. And again, for a little bit of perspective here, at the Paris Agreement in 2015, we were looking at, or we were on track for a 3.7 degree increase. So we are making progress on this commitment, but there is still quite a bit of work to go. And importantly, a lot of these commitments are not legally binding. They are not yet written into national policies. And so we need to see some of these commitments to net zero being codified into national policies that will really have force behind them. The second area that I would say was super important heading into this event, and something that was laser focused for people watching this, was the idea of financing the transition. Back in 2009 in Copenhagen, developed countries had pledged $100 billion a year by 2020 to poor countries in order to battle climate change. And that goal has not been met. Estimates today are that developed countries are contributing about $80 billion a year rather than $100 billion. We're almost in 2022 at this point, and we are still falling short of that $100 billion mark. Toby made mention of this, that there was language to more significantly ratchet this up, and it was removed from the final agreement. Instead, the pact says that countries are urged to double their funding levels for financing commitments by 2025. So I would say this is one of the major areas that we've actually been disappointed in the final agreement. And then on the third portion, in terms of what we were looking for going into COP26, all about the international carbon markets and the negotiation of the so-called Article 6. Once again, Toby provided some detail on this, so I won't go into too much detail here. But I will say, while there is room for improvement and further negotiation on this, the fact that we were able to break the deadlock after 6 years of negotiating and really sort of finalize this final component of the Paris rulebook does represent remarkable progress. So again, a mixed scorecard. Progress made on very important issues. This is a very comprehensive agreement, but there is still a lot of work to do. And I think you saw that in the disappointment from some of the activists who were protesting just outside the conference halls throughout the last 2 weeks, and particularly over the weekend.
Yeah, that I think that was a good summary there. Sounds like we're moving in the right direction, but there's a long road ahead of us. So let's do this. As a follow-up for Toby, one of the moments that got a lot of headlines over the last 2 weeks was the joint statement between the U.S. and China. I'm curious how significant that agreement was in pushing talks forward, and what does it mean for future cooperation on climate initiatives?
Finally, there was a breakthrough about midweek where China and the U.S. Got together. You had Xinjiang and Kerry agreeing, simply that they are the world's largest emitters. We can't deny that. And that they would take, more stringent steps to cut emissions and reduce pollution. This joint statement was impressive, and we were happy to see this. However, there weren't really concrete pledges or metrics or any detail in that statement. Kerry did announce, however, that we are in fact closer than we've ever been before to avoiding a climate, chaotic disaster and securing cleaner air and safer water, a healthier planet, because of this statement and this agreement made by the US and China. I would suppose the good news here is that, China and the US are talking, right? They're talking climate amid the broader diplomatic standoff. And it is progress based on what we've seen in the past. What is good is even this evening, President Joe Biden is set to virtually meet Chinese President Xi Jinping to further discuss some details along that statement. So we may actually see further explanation as to what this joint commitment means. So more to see on that, but glad to see that there are discussions and again, fortitude and forward thinking based from the largest two emitters in the world. So good to see.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, from the largest two emitters in the world, it needs to, clearly be some leadership there. So, one thing, Haley, that you've talked to about before, and maybe even on this podcast, but certainly in your written pieces, are reporting standards. So, more specifically, we've heard a lot about the evolution of reporting standards. So I'm curious if we had any major developments on that front.
Yeah, we've joked in the past, and I think it is on this podcast, we've joked about sort of the alphabet soup of all of the different frameworks for voluntary reporting. There's TCFD, there's SASB, there's several others, and not to add a few more letters to the mix, but one major development that did come out of COP, as expected, the IFRS, which, as most of our listeners know, is a globally recognized international accounting standard setter. The IFRS did launch the International Sustainability Standards Board, or the ISSB. And while on the face of it, it may seem like this adds more letters to the mix and makes it more confusing, it's actually going to be a big step forward in streamlining what is expected of international standards and what is expected for reporting standards. The ISSB will acquire the Value Reporting Foundation that is expected to close next year. So that incorporates the SASB framework as well. And it really, I think, will bring a lot of clarity to sort of what investors expect companies to report, what standards they expect companies to adhere to in their reporting. I will note, though, that even if the ISSB makes progress in sort of streamlining and standardizing the expectations around reporting, these will not automatically become mandatory. ISSB standards would have to be approved in each jurisdiction before coming into force. So certainly a long way to go before we get standardized international reporting guidelines, but certainly a step in the right direction. I do also want to highlight here one development outside of COP that was very important from the regulatory side in the United States. Last week, we heard a speech from the acting comptroller of the currency. And as we know, the OCC is one of the major financial regulators in the US. And in this speech, he said that the OCC would issue more formal climate change guidance by the end of this year. And he went out to, he went on to lay out five questions that US banks should be assessing. And these five questions are really likely to be the blueprint for the issues that will be covered in future guidance. So the questions are, number one, what is our overall exposure to climate change? Number two, which counterparties, sectors, or locales warrant our heightened attention and focus? Number three, how exposed are we to a carbon tax? Number four, how vulnerable are our data centers and other critical services to extreme weather events? And number five, what can we do to position ourselves to seize opportunities from climate change? This speech notably follows the report that came out from FSOC last month. And it's just one more step highlighting the ways that major US regulatory bodies are incorporating climate risk into their frameworks. So really incorporating both the domestic US agenda as well as the international side that we saw over the last 2 weeks from COP26.
And that's an amazing amount of sort of progress. I mean, as just a casual observer of things ESG, I mean, seeing real guidance for disclosures, you know, just seems like something I would have never even been thinking about or been on my radar, you know, like a year ago. Great stuff as always. And for our listeners, I'd really encourage you to watch for more updates from MUFG's capital market strategy team. And if you aren't receiving them, please get in touch with Haley, Toby, or myself. And thanks again for joining us, both Haley and Toby.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the MUFG Global Markets Podcast. Rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and reach out to your MUFG sales rep for any further information. Check back soon for more insights from the Global Markets Research Team.